It's the 20th of November, 1722. 100 miles or so west of Barbados, on a small island in the Lesser Antilles, the pirate brigantine Good Fortune, commanded by Bridstock Weaver, is anchored alongside Captain Thomas Anstice's flagship, the Morning Star. Both flank their captured prize, a London merchant ship called the Dolphin. As with all their captures, they quickly and efficiently strip away anything of value. About 300 pounds of English money, 300 pieces of eight, along with tackle, furniture, and 40 gallons of rum. Not a bad haul. But as ever, just as valuable is her crew. Anstice's pirate fleet is always in need of skilled men. Coopers to maintain their supplies, carpenters to maintain their vessels, surgeons to maintain their health. The list goes on. Once upon a time, dozens would have volunteered to join the pirates. But that time has passed. In truth, their crew is already overstocked with rebellious, dissatisfied sailors, just waiting for their chance to escape. But Thomas Anstice is no fool. A pirate of nearly 5 years, far longer than most, he knows how to balance risk and reward, and how to keep a crew in line. With the company gathered on deck of the Morning Star, he makes a bold play. Or perhaps it's a demonstration. He declares, "Any man who wishes to leave the company is free to do so." There's a stunned silence among the men assembled on deck. An eerie silence. The only sound is the creaking of the ship and the occasional flap of a sail. No one dares step forward. Anstice repeats his offer. "You're free to go. I'll keep none against their inclination." Captain Bridstock Weaver stands beside Captain Anstice, scrutinizing the sailors in front of him. To many in the crew, he must appear as a sentinel barring their escape. But those who know him best likely suspect that he too would dearly love to step forward and walk free if he could. With more encouragement, eventually a half a dozen or so of the recently forced men do summon the courage to speak up. They find Anstice is as good as his word. Grasping the opportunity, they hurriedly load a rowboat and pile in, fearing the pirates will change their minds. Indeed, the watching crew mutter and shift about uncomfortably. There's a violent tension rising in the air. Some would rather kill these men than allow them to leave and report them. Others are tired of the pirate life and long to join them, but fear the consequences of sailing into a colonial harbor. Others simply fear the reaction of their mates. In short, no one is happy. Just as the boat is about to launch, there's a sudden commotion. A single pirate by the name of George Blackadder makes a break for it. Damn the consequences, he wants out. He dashes across the deck and nearly dives head first over the ladder, scrambling aboard the departing boat. But his bid for freedom is quickly snuffed out. Another pirate, William Hall, is having none of it. Allowing recently forced men to go is one thing. Allowing a veteran pirate, a member of the company, to do so is unforgivable. He grabs a gunner's iron ramrod leaning against the railing and jumps down into the boat after Blackadder. Hall rages. "You came aboard voluntarily, and now you're leaving us." Not waiting for an answer, Hall swings the rod, smashing it across the cowering man's face, catching him square in the eye. Blackadder collapses unconscious. Snarling, Hall still delivers several sharp kicks to the man's ribs before seizing him and dragging him back on board the ship. Bridstock Weaver, along with the entire crew, watches the grim scene unfold. But none of them are surprised. None of them are free to leave. Anstis nods and, turning on his heels, returns to his cabin. I'm Tom Morton, and welcome to Real Pirates, the show that dives deep into the true story behind the world's most notorious buccaneers. Join us as we set sail under the Black Flag, alongside such legendary figures as Blackbeard, Henry Morgan, Charles Vane, Anne Bonny, and Mary Read. We'll reveal how these marauding mariners rose to dominate the seven seas, the terror tactics they employed to overpower their prey, and what life was really like aboard their ships. Their reputations have swollen to legendary proportions, making it hard to separate fact from fiction. Who were they? Terrorists or freedom fighters? Cold-blooded killers or heroic underdogs? As it turns out, the truth is far stranger than fiction.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The 36-year-old Bridstock Weaver is an uncommon pirate. His story began like many others. Over a year ago, he was a skilled sailor forced to join a pirate company, made to sign their articles under pain of death. But while many forced men quickly accept their fate, it seems that even after months of abuse, Weaver still refused to take part in their piracy or accept a share in the spoils. But eventually, Weaver's open defiance shrank to passive resistance. Staying alive became his only occupation. But then, in November 1721, his story took an extraordinary turn. Apparently, his resilience also earned him admirers. Against all odds, and perhaps to his own bewilderment, he was elected by his crewmates to the position of captain aboard the brigantine Good Fortune. Bridstock Weaver, the reluctant pirate, now commands a ship and a crew of desperate criminals. Now, it's December 1721, a month after his unexpected promotion, and a year before the capture of the Dolphin. As an anonymous sailor and a forced man, Weaver has always hoped to escape prosecution, if he can escape at all. But being made captain changes everything. Dr. James Rankin is a historian and an authority on pirates.
We love to think of the pirate captain as a confident, enthusiastic, extremely sort of willing participant in piracy. And Weaver kind of gives us an example of someone who doesn't seem that keen on it. But once he becomes captain, you know, it's worth asking the question, could he have simply sailed his ship into a harbor and surrendered with a crew who wasn't particularly keen on that, right? As even though he had potentially insulated himself from prosecution by taking the time to sort of establish this persona that he had created during his time with pirates, it seems unlikely that he could have convinced his entire crew that it was worth taking that gamble. So it is one of those situations, and I think some other pirate captains, it's worth asking that question, you know, whether or not it is a cursed crown where once you become the captain, your exposure to legal prosecution ramps up significantly. And then suddenly, you know, you might have second thoughts, you know.
Weaver intends to do what he has always done. Survive. And frankly, his choices are limited. Although he is captain of his own vessel, he and his crew still sail under the overall leadership of Pirate Commodore Thomas Anstice. Despite Anstice sailing aboard his own 32-gun flagship, the Morning Star, and backed by Weaver's 18-gun brigantine, this powerful fleet is undermined by divisions within the crew. Anstice has his work cut out for him to keep the company together. In fact, according to contemporary historian Charles Johnson, now that they had two good ships well manned, it may be supposed they were in a condition to undertake something bold. But their government was disturbed by malcontents, and a kingdom divided within itself cannot stand. Whatever the captain proposed, it was certainly carried against him. According to Johnson, the pirates, unable to decide on a course of action, agree to write a petition to King George I, proclaiming their innocence and requesting a royal pardon. But this is where fact and fiction get murky, as is so often the case in Johnson's accounts. However, historians believe that Anstice's own crewman, Thomas Jones, seems to be a key contemporary source for Johnson's 1724 General History of the Pirates.
If you don't make it into the general history, you just kind of disappear from the collective memory until someone goes and digs you back up, really. And I think Thomas Lawrence Jones, I have my suspicions that he probably contributed a lot in terms of the details in the Anstice and Roberts chunks of the text, but it's hard to prove. As much as I'll spend all my time dunking on the general history, it does suggest that whoever wrote it did have access to eyewitnesses who knew things that you could not know from any other source. And that's why we can't just throw it away completely, but it's just so aggravating because, you know, we can never pull apart where the sort of embroidery ends and the cloth begins, you know, it's a tough one.
According to Johnson, presumably via Thomas Jones, in December 1721, the pirate fleet sails to the uninhabited island of Roatan in the Bay of Honduras to live a marooning life while they await an answer to their petition. No doubt Bridstock Weaver must be overjoyed at the suggestion. All he needs to do is pilot his ship, keep her seaworthy, and manage the crew whilst they wait for the news. Even if the petition is unsuccessful, at the very least he might get a chance to escape whilst on shore. Whether they really did send a petition for pardon or not, spending the winter Caribbean months dancing and drinking on a desert island isn't uncommon for pirate crews. Though what Johnson suggests the pirates do for fun during this time is both curious and also revealing about the pirates' view of life. Dr. Manashag Powell is a cultural historian and an authority on pirates.
So after they're done dancing, the other thing they like to do is hold mock trials. Now, Johnson gives us, in fact, a very detailed account of one such trial as sort of a flavor, so we get the sense of how this worked. Did this actually happen as described? Hard to say. We do know that mock trials were a thing, but the interesting twist that Johnson presents us with is that the pirates have a game where they rotate who's the judge and who's the prisoner. And so, you know, whoever's the judge one night is the prisoner the next night, vice versa. And there's a lot of play acting and fun involved with, you know, kind of a nice hearty dose of social commentary, right?
Supposedly, the pirates hold these make-believe piracy trials where an uncaring, lazy judge hands out arbitrary death sentences because he's bored and hungry and wants to go to bed. Turning a deaf ear to the accused pirate's reasons and turning a blind eye to any evidence in their defense. It's a scathing satire on injustice within Britain's maritime legal system.
So it's a really interesting interlude for people that want to see pirates as conscious of their social outcast status, that this was apparently put forth by one of Johnson's informants, potentially Jones, as one of the ways they have of talking about their status and working through it, that they make it a source of fun and amusement and mockery to pass the time while they're allegedly waiting for a pardon. So I'm not persuaded that this necessarily happened as it's laid out by Johnson. But I think the individual elements separated, like, did pirates have mock trials? Yeah, probably. Did they mock the justice system to which they knew they might one day well be subject? That seems entirely plausible. Did they have a flair for the dramatic? Yes, all kinds of evidence that that's true. So I like to think of this as kind of an amalgamation of a lot of different stories kind of put together as one that's plausible in general, if not in this specific case here.
Whether all this happened as Jones or Johnson claims is debatable. It seems plausible, but official timelines are somewhat blurred. Especially in doubt is the alleged length of their stay on Roatan. Johnson and Jones both claim Anstis's company stay on land for 9 months, living peacefully, relaxing, and putting on plays, specifically avoiding committing any kind of crime. No doubt a number of the hostages, forced men, unwilling pirates, and those wanting to retire really do wish this is what happened. Perhaps Bridstock Weaver most of all. But other historical sources seem to suggest that if they did stop on Roatan, it certainly wasn't for 9 months. And they certainly didn't avoid pirating during that time. Some or all of Anstis's pirate gang, in fact, spend most of the year 1722 cruising up and down the North American coast, pirating to their heart's content, taking dozens of small merchants, local traders, and fishing vessels, wreaking havoc and destruction all the way up to Nova Scotia and back again. And it would seem the brigantine Good Fortune is right at the heart of it, commanded by Bridstock Weaver. Some witnesses claim he personally oversees the capture of 50 or more vessels. Quite the turnaround for the supposedly reluctant pirate. It's April 22nd, 1722. After several months cruising up to Newfoundland and back, the Good Fortune is back in the Caribbean, sailing westward of the Leeward Islands. Captain Weaver has been in command for nearly 6 months, and he now assesses the merchant ship off his bow. A London vessel, the Portland. He gives the order to attack. The pirates board the English merchant and round up the crew and passengers, herding them onto the main deck. Men tremble, women quake, and children cry. All are terrified at what horrors might await them. Pirate Quartermaster John White leads the vicious band of invaders. The master of the Portland, Captain Levitt, steps forward to demand clemency for his crew in consideration for their prompt surrender. Reply comes in the form of a sharp blow to the face with the flat blade of a cutlass from one of the pirates. A rough, elderly-looking sailor they call Old South. Levitt stumbles backwards, clutching his mangled nose. Looking around, he casts a pleading look towards the pirate's captain, who stands apart from the rest. Captain Bridstock Weaver is unmoved, silent and impassive. The pirates proceed to tear through the ship's hold and the passengers' belongings. The women are harassed and the men are whipped and beaten, forced to give up anything of value. Aside from jewelry, pocket watches, and some gold buttons, they take a cache of coins and 10 pipes of fine wine, valued at £250. As the pirates navigate the prize ship to Hispaniola, Bidstock Weaver takes up residence in Captain Levitt's cabin. Still sitting on deck, his face still running with blood, the wounded Levitt shakes with fury and quietly curses. He occasionally glances up to see Weaver sitting behind his own oak desk, drinking from his silver cup. Weaver eventually calls in the waiting quartermaster and assesses the spoils presented to him, making notes and divvying up the shares due to his crew. Finally, he signals for three of the Portland's crew to be brought in, men with skills the pirates can use. These volunteers include one Robert Dalton, who, like the others, will be forced under threat of death to sign the pirates' articles and join their band. However heartfelt his reluctance to piracy was before, as captain, he's now inescapably involved.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details.
The captain does have absolute authority during times of battle. So that makes Weaver's claim that he's a forced man really interesting, because typically one of the things that somebody who's making that defense will try to say is that they weren't either trusted with weapons during boarding. That's always a sign that they weren't considered happy pirates, or that they refused to take part in battle, or that they stayed below deck or something like that. If Weaver's the captain, he can't possibly claim any of those things.
Undeniably, Bidstock Weaver engaged in piracy and was present, boarded ships, captured ships. That is the textbook definition of piracy. He was the captain, right? He was not a nameless sailor. He couldn't really hide behind the pirate equivalent of just following orders.
It would seem the story of Bidstock Weaver has come full circle. One witness, Ezekiel Davis, would later claim he watched Bidstock lead from the front during the plundering of prizes, stating Weaver was pretty active, without showing sign of being compelled to it. Then again, what else can he do? He's damned if he gets caught pirating, and damned by his crew and by Commodore Anstis if he refuses. Whatever action he takes may have dire consequences for him.
It's a difficult, messy, often, very ambiguous situation where men have very good reasons to be deceptive to other pirates, to witnesses, right? Like all of us, when we go to work, sometimes you put on your work face. And I think that there are probably pirates out there who are doing the same thing. I do think it's difficult to really disentangle what parts of Weaver are calculated decisions that are aimed more at maneuvering within what he anticipates to be a very dangerous legal situation, and what parts of Weaver are just expressions of his personality. Every ship that they're taking presents a new set of difficult decisions. And so, how do you treat prisoners? Which ships do you let go and where do you let them go? He's going to have to make a lot of very difficult decisions in this position. And it's a shame that we don't know a ton about what he actually was doing. We have some descriptions of the attacks, but we don't get a lot of insight into Weaver's personal conduct at the helm of this crew.
By the summer of 1722, Anstis's company have taken numerous prizes. But despite their success, the internal tensions haven't eased. As they capture more vessels and force more men on board, the balance of willing pirates to unwilling captives threatens to tip over. In addition, within the hardcore nucleus of the crew, a number of veteran pirates now also want out, whilst others want to up the ante. The bonds between these pirate brethren are starting to fray.
So that's the paradox, right, at the center of Ansys's career as Johnson lays it out, which is that it starts with a pirate crew peacefully separating, and it ends with a pirate crew not being able to peacefully separate, and instead murder and mayhem ensue. Part of the answer may be the number of forced men on board the ship. And also, we know the career went from what, around 1720 to, you know, the very end was 1723 and 24. That's actually quite a long time for people to be pirates. Normally, it didn't last that long. And so some of these people are sick of the lifestyle. They've tried it out. They did it. They had their laughs. They want to be done with it. And so there's, on the one hand, people never buying into it. And on the other hand, people who've become disillusioned. And then there's a fraught middle who are neither of those things and don't understand why everybody's being a killjoy. And so there seems to be maybe even more bitterness against the people who willingly were pirates and now don't want to be pirates anymore than the forced men, because you can understand, well, I did force you to become a pirate at gunpoint. I'm not going to let you go, but I do understand the bad feelings and their origin, versus, you know, the men who are like, but we've been brothers for years. Why do you want to leave me now?
November 1722, somewhere between Hispaniola and Barbados, Anstis captures the London merchant ship Dolphin. With the crew close to breaking point, Anstis appears to choose democracy over dictatorship. He offers to break up the company, promising that he'll keep no man against their will.
And when we think about pirate crews, like any other workplace, right? Complicated, often quite fractious, and at times divided groups of men vying for influence, interpersonal relationships, both friendly and not so friendly. All of these things are playing out. And it's a very tight space. You know, you can't really avoid some of these conflicts on a ship. There's nowhere to go. You know, you can't really cool off if things really get a bit too tense. So all of that is contributing, I think, to pirate crews becoming increasingly prone to crises of desertion, splits within crews.
Things are falling apart, and not everyone is happy about it. According to some witnesses, after the capture of the Dolphin, six or seven men do leave the company. But one pirate, William Hall, takes an exception to his friend George Blackadder trying to leave, viciously beating him over the perceived betrayal.
And we also see increasingly measures taken to discourage desertion, right? To build up a sense of dread about the consequences of trying to flee without following, you know, whatever set of procedures is laid out there. Particularly amongst committed pirates, if your mate decides he's out, you know, he's had enough, instantly your relationship shifts from one where you are fellow crew on a pirate ship to one in which this person could potentially be standing opposite you in a courtroom describing your crimes to a jury. So there is a very powerful incentive to maintain discipline, you know, within a crew to prevent anyone who's in a position to really speak to some of these crimes from leaving the company and potentially being captured, right? And then being a witness against you, right? Or offering testimony that would be read into the record that could put you in a noose.
When push comes to shove, leaving a pirate crew is a treacherous business, which explains why so many forced men stay put and keep their heads down. According to the pirates' articles, in theory, any crewman can petition to leave the company and it would be put to a vote. But it's a long shot, as Benjamin Sapes discovers. In his case, although the Anstis crew votes in favor of letting him leave, it only takes one vote against to veto it. And in this case, the vote of committed pirate William Ingram. In fact, Ingram, one of the hardened core, seems to brutally repress splitters. On another occasion, he chases after a Portuguese crewmate, slashing at him with a cutlass, and even firing a musket at him as he attempts to flee whilst on shore. Even Charles Johnson's star witness, Thomas Jones, who would later escape back to England himself to proclaim his innocence, was apparently a chief enforcer whilst aboard. He's instrumental in holding a disciplinary court of punishment for would-be deserters, sentencing two crewmates to death while brutally flogging several others. It's hard to know what Bridstock Weaver makes of all this. Himself having been forced and long walked the careful path to survive, he now must watch on as men he is responsible for are so badly treated. Does his conscience stir? Does he have a choice? How long will his purgatory continue? Things finally come to a head at the end of 1722. Thomas Anstis is voted out of command, and John Fenn replaces him as Commodore and Commander of the Morning Star. Fenn is a veteran known as the One-Handed Man. His disability is evidence of his experience. As Chief Gunnery Officer, he's a senior voice and leader.
We do know that Fenn, unlike what you might expect of a gunner, in fact had a disability. He had lost his hand at some point, so probably a lot of his work is kind of giving orders. We also know that Fenn is written up as the One-Handed Man, is how he's referred to in a couple of places. So this seems to be pretty reliable. And in fact, pirates did lose limbs with a lot of frequency. But I would point out here that Fenn is one-handed. At no point does anyone suggest that he wears a hook prosthesis. And in fact, there's no evidence anywhere of a Golden Age pirate who wore a hook prosthesis, although we do have a couple of one-armed specimens, including Fenn. So it's another one of those areas where the late 19th century and then Disney have given us something that we all grow up believing that just doesn't seem to be supported.
We also don't have any record of why Fenn is selected and what his motivations are. Whether this is a power play by an ambitious would-be captain, or whether he too is reluctantly forced into it. Whatever the case, Bridstock Weaver is clearly still popular and trusted, as he remains in command of the Good Fortune.
It's so weird, right? So Weaver, who is the force man that nobody can really understand how he's elected captain, remains kind of a steady hand at the tiller, if you'll forgive the figure of speech. Whereas, meanwhile, we've got Anstis and our one-handed pirate Fenn switching back and forth, but apparently peacefully. Like, there doesn't seem to be any bloodshed that's recorded, as, you know, one is voted out, the other one's voted in, but they remain on the same ship working together and are able to change positions more than once. So again, do we read this as evidence that pirate democracy actually does mostly work until it doesn't? Do we read this as evidence that Anstis is really an odd pirate? He has basically every position on that ship he can have, some of them more than once, and that doesn't seem to be entirely typical. Or is there something between these two men that's just kind of been lost to history? Do they have a special dynamic to their relationship?
Perhaps in reality, neither Anstis or Fenn particularly wants the mantle of Commodore, as it looks more and more like a cursed crown thrust upon them.
The relationship between Weaver, Anstis, and Fenn, again, raises some questions about to what extent any of them were necessarily seeking the captaincy on their own cognizance. And in a way, maybe they even have a sort of a shared understanding where whosoever's sort of fortunes are waxing or waning at any given time, both of them sort of understand that when the crew decides that your time as captain is over and someone else's time as captain is beginning, it's not necessarily a matter of personal conflict between the two, but conditions have shifted. And again, you know, this goes back to the volatility of crews in general. Again, can we imagine Fenn as sort of reluctantly being like, oh God, now I'm the captain, now I'm on the hook, right? Now my name is going to be the one that every victim, you know, every officer of the ship that we take is going to go in a port and report captained by John Fenn. Not much I can do about it though, because I can't turn this down either.
Whatever the truth behind Anstis, Weaver and Fenn's relationship, this uprising has been a long time coming. But if the company hoped their fortunes will improve under John Fenn's leadership, they were about to be disappointed. Fenn's captaincy gets off to an inauspicious start. It's January 1723. The pirate fleet sails to the Cayman Islands, where they run into a storm head-on. Caught in high winds and rough seas, the Morning Star, under Fenn's command, runs aground on the island's razor-sharp coral reefs. The pirates' powerful flagship is wrecked, damaged beyond repair. Captain Weaver, excellent navigator that he is, manages to steer a safer course, heaving off into the wind and away from the treacherous shoals. From aboard the Good Fortune, he can only watch as the Morning Star is dragged back and forth over the jagged reefs. His crew stare in horror at the ship listing over in the shallows, as Fenn, Anstice and company scramble to save their lives. Even amidst the crash of thunder and pounding waves, it's easy to imagine Bridstock Weaver considering his next course of action. When the storm abates, he'll have a decision to make. Rescue his commander and his crewmates? Or sail for freedom? Then again, with 100 or so pirates on board his own brigantine, he's hardly free to do as he pleases. One wrong move could be fatal.
So when we think about Weaver and some of these other captains during the 1720s, we have to remember that they are making immensely complicated calculations about how to manage this ever-shifting human terrain on board their ships. At the same time that they're also trying to, you know, avoid pirate hunters, find prizes, collect loot, there are so many different pressures building up. And in any pressure cooker situation, there is always potential for an explosion. These men were already in a perilous profession, found themselves swept into proximity with pirates through the vagaries of fate. And then the question is, you know, how do you survive in that context?
The next morning, as the tide allows, he sends rescue parties ashore to pull the survivors from the wreck. According to witnesses, John Fenn, Anstice, and the majority of the crew are rescued and come aboard the Good Fortune. And the balance of power shifts again. Fenn assumes command, and Weaver is demoted back to first mate. No doubt much to his relief. After nearly 2.5 years amongst the pirates, his captor Anstice is out of favor, and Weaver is no longer under the scrutiny of being in command himself. The pirates plot a course back to their base on the Honduran island of Roatan to regroup and make repairs. Weaver knows, once ashore, for the first time in a long time, he might soon have an opportunity to break free. The crew won't let him go willingly, so he'll have to chance it. It's now or never. It's late evening in November 1722 on Roatan Island in the Bay of Honduras. The Good Fortune is grounded in the shallows of a secluded harbor. Anchored nearby are a couple of recently captured prize vessels. They're careening and making repairs, meaning cannons and cargo have been unloaded. And the pirates are in no state to make sail. Bridstock Weaver has been secretly plotting an escape with a handful of trusted men. For the past few days, they've passed secret messages below decks, exchanged knowing looks and subtle nods. Weaver fears discovery, rightly so, knowing firsthand how deserters are dealt with. Even if he didn't relish his role as captain, Bridstock Weaver did what was expected, executing his duties to the best of his abilities. But in doing so, he has overseen torment and torture, heard victims cry, and witnessed new captives, men just like him, abused and imprisoned, just as he was. It's easy to imagine his shame, his conscience cringing in disgust. His hands are now as dirty as his captors, or rather, his crewmates. Then again, it's also possible that Weaver just judges that the time is right to break from a divided company hurtling towards disaster. Whatever his true motivations, after the recent turmoil, he now spies a chance to finally be free. But he must act fast. He gathers a number of supporters who he knows also want to escape, and in the dead of night, under cover of darkness, they launch a boat and row over to one of their recent prizes anchored nearby. As quietly as they can, they make the Spanish merchant ship ready to sail. Weaver's elation at the idea of freedom is overwhelmed by the fear of being caught. He constantly eyes the glowing fires on the beach and listens to the singing and laughter carried on the air, straining his ears for any sign of alarm. Eventually, they are ready. He gives the order to cut the cables. Under the moonless sky, they hoist the sails and silently drift away. Next time on Real Pirates. Britstock Weaver washes up on the shores of Britain, but faces a dilemma. Does he try and return to the honorable life that he lost? Or should he try to live in secret and remain alone? The decision may be taken out of his hands by a ghost from his past. Meanwhile, things go from bad to worse for the unfortunate pirate crew of the Good Fortune. Anstis and Fenn are hunted, hounded, and headed for disaster. That's next time on Real Pirates. Real Pirates is a Spotify original from Parcast, produced in partnership with Noiser. Executive produced by Max Cutler, Drew Cole, and Pascal Hughes. Developed by Julian Boireau for Parcast. Written and produced by McAllister Bexon. Sound supervisor, Tom Pink. Edited by Carla Flores and Rob Plummer. Sound design by Matias Torres Sole. Mixmaster by Cody Reynolds Shaw. Music by Oliver Baines and Dory McCauley.